In 1922, Lillian Knox ran one of the largest lumber companies in the state of Texas. She was known for her business savvy, her take charge attitude, and her acts of kindness to the timber families who worked hard to make the company a success. She also received attention from investigators who felt her husband's sudden death, allegedly of suicide, was suspicious. They believed Lillian was a killer. This is the mystery of Lillian Knox, the Lady Bountiful of East Texas. This is Southern Mysteries.
It's gonna be all right. These ain't dark or troubled times. It's a day like any other day. You got a dark and troubled mind, all right. You hold that baby tight, and I swear if you can hear me, then everything gonna be just fine, all right. All right.
Welcome to Southern Mysteries, exploring historical mysteries and legendary figures of the American South. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. Since the 1750s, the term Lady Bountiful has been used to describe women who like to be noticed for their benevolence, their act of kindness, visits with the poor. They have never shied away from praise bestowed on them. Lillian Knox fit that bill. The Lady Bountiful of East Texas worked hard to rise above her poor upbringing. She married well when she met and married her second husband, Hiram Knox Jr., who inherited his family's successful timber business and their fortune. Hiram's lack of business savvy would lead to Lillian taking charge of the company and serving as a strong leader and a gentle caregiver to the community, giving large amounts of money away to help improve the town and care for its citizens. Lillian loved every bit of the attention that came with the Knox business and name, but Hiram Knox Jr.'s life and risky business choices put all of that at risk. When Hiram was found dead in their family home in November of 1922, investigators immediately suspected that the Lady Bountiful had taken matters into her own hands to rid herself of a husband who had been weighing her down, keeping her from the man she really wanted, and threatening their livelihood. The story of the Knox family legacy and wealth began in Wisconsin when William Knox, who referred to himself as Colonel, despite having never served in the military, married Mary Axford. The colonel used his wife's inheritance to invest in lumber, and the investment paid off. The colonel opened several sawmills in Wisconsin and ran a successful timber business, accumulating a fortune of over $10 million. In 1900, the colonel moved the family from Wisconsin to Dallas, Texas. The family who came with him to Texas included his wife, Mary, their son, Hiram, and Hiram's wife, Grace, along with their son, Willie. By 1902, the colonel expanded his lands and holdings when he bought about 10,000 acres of timberland near Livingston, Texas, in Polk County. They established a community they called Knox. In 1903, they built a sawmill there in town, which fueled the growth of their company town to about 500 residents. Company towns, as they were known, were popular business and community models in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Mine, plantation, timber, and sawmill owners would build their company around the housing, support, and control of their employees. Some even created their own currency, such as Knox bucks, that could be spent in the general store in town. There were hundreds of company towns in Texas between the 1890s until the end of World War II. They would rise and thrive quickly, and over time, as business and the economy would ebb and flow, those towns would fade away, many of them becoming ghost towns once the mills closed, never to be inhabited again. Lumber camps and sawmill towns were the most popular company towns in East Texas. More and more workers were leaving farms and turning to company employment and the booming business of timber in the early 20th century. The Knox Lumber Company thrived in East Texas and logged out the pineries it owned in Polk County. The company faced a scare in 1908 when the colonel became very ill and had to take a step back from the business. Colonel Knox hired an attractive young nurse to care for him as he dealt with a bout of pneumonia, which was a serious and often deadly condition at the time. The nurse the colonel hired to move into the Knox mansion and care for him was Lillian Marshall. Lillian Marguerite Marshall was born in Michigan on November 15th of 1891. We know very little about her life as a young woman, apart from the fact that at some point in the late 1890s, her family moved to Texarkana, Texas. She had grown up poor, which may explain why she married at such an early age. It may have been an attempt to improve her situation. In 1906, when Lillian was 15 years old, she married her first husband, Roy LaRue. The marriage wouldn't last long. Lillian and Roy would separate and divorce when Lillian worked for the Knox family. Lillian worked hard to care for Colonel Knox. She also worked hard to earn the trust of the family, especially the Colonel and his son, Hiram Jr. Hiram Knox Jr. would find comfort and support from Lillian when less than a year after she began working in the Knox home, in 1908, Hiram's wife Grace died of what was said to be a blood disease. Willie, the son of Hiram Jr. and Grace, would die soon after. People began to wonder if the Knox family was cursed. So much loss, so suddenly. As Hiram Knox dealt with the loss of his wife and son, Lillian was there to offer comfort while she was still married to Roy LaRue. Lillian would divorce LaRue and marry Hiram Knox Jr. in 1910 when she was 19. Hiram was 47. Years later, it would be revealed that their first son, William Hiram, wasn't born in 1912 as he had been told. He was born in 1909, a year before Hiram and Lillian were married. The Colonel leaned on his son Hiram and his daughter-in-law Lillian, asking for their help when he made the decision that the mill in Knox had run its course. All timber on the land around the mill had been exhausted, and it was time to move on and open a new company town in nearby Sabine County. In 1912, the Colonel began preparations for the transition to a new mill on 25,000 acres. But the Colonel wouldn't live to carry out that transition. On June 26, 1913, the Colonel was staying at the Brazos Hotel in Houston when he suddenly died. The week of his death, the Lumber Trade Journal printed his obituary, writing, "Mr. Knox was 79 years of age at the time of his death. He planned to construct a new and immense sawmill plant in Sabine County. Plans of this far-seeing lumberman will be completed by his only son, Hiram Knox Jr., who was at his father's bedside when the final summons came." Colonel Knox's death certificate noted that his cause of death was undetermined and has remained undetermined. Hiram and Lillian inherited the family enterprise from the Colonel's estate. They carried out the plan the Colonel had in place. They completed the sawmill in the new company town of East Mayfield near Hemphill, Texas. The couple built a large home, and Lillian furnished it with all kinds of expensive furniture and art. Lillian loved the chance to furnish and head up decorating her home and care for the growing family. Lillian and Hiram would have 8 children. But Lillian wanted to be more involved in the Knox business. As one reporter noted, Lillian had a business acumen which was entirely lacking in her husband. So much so that as the family settled into East Mayfield and operations at the sawmill were booming, Lillian Knox would be the one heading up the Knox Lumber Company, not Hiram Knox Jr. Hiram Knox Jr. got the Colonel's money, but Jr. wasn't an ambitious man. He enjoyed what he could do with the money, such as hunting, fishing, and all kinds of activities he considered to be much more fun than running a business. Hiram had his fun, and Lillian took charge of the day-to-day operations, heading up public relations and making business decisions that Hiram didn't care to make. Hiram trusted Lillian because she was good at taking charge. She was actively engaged with every aspect of the business, which caused tension with the employees early on. It was the early 20th century, and men were not accustomed to taking orders from women. Over time, Lillian earned the trust of the men who worked for her. She was hands-on, would show up at the sawmill in a pair of overalls to manage business affairs. She adapted, and in time, the employees, well, they grew to like her and her management style. In 1917, Hiram Knox signed a lucrative contract for the company to supply large timbers for coastal shipyards. Hiram signed the deal, stayed home, and Lillian put her overalls on and ordered around logging crews who were doing the work. In 1918, the American Lumberman magazine declared Lillian Knox to be the most remarkable woman in the lumber industry. Here was Lillian Knox wearing overalls, bossing around logging crews during the day, and at night, attending to the needs of employees and the community at large. Lillian earned the love and respect of sawmill families by caring for children. Parents would call on her when their child was ill because they knew she was a nurse. She often cared for sick children, and their parents referred to Lillian as an angel of mercy. Her charity seemed endless. She built a new hospital to ensure everyone in the community could get the care they needed as quickly as possible. When a child was born, Lillian opened an account at the bank in their name to help the family provide for their child. She ordered that a library be built in town. The Lady Bountiful had a big pocketbook, shared it with the people of town, and loved the adoration and praise that came with her giving spirit. In fact, during a tribute held to honor Lillian's great works, a speaker referred to Lillian as the greatest individual benefactor Sabine County and its people ever had. Lillian had attained her worship status among the sawmill families. Her husband, Hiram, well, not so much. Hiram Knox had a habit of making poor financial decisions, was said to have not treated Lillian any better than she treated him. Some of his business decisions were made without Lillian's knowledge. One decision in particular would cost the Knox family greatly and lead to the destruction of Knox Industries. Hiram Knox believed that the First World War would last a very long time. He viewed it as a never-ending war that his company could benefit from in time with more contracts from those coastal shipyards. He took out many loans from banks so he could buy more timberland. By November of 1918, Hiram Knox had Knox Industries deep in debt to banks. That month, the armistice that ended the war caught Hiram Knox by surprise. He never saw it coming, and he was in trouble. His risky business decisions meant he had to do something to secure his remaining fortune. He sold Knox Industries to a competing timber operator, Temple Lumber Company. The sale was finalized in 1921 for $2 million. On November 26, 1922, Lillian Knox called police to her home around 3 a.m., She told the first officer on scene she heard what had sounded like a gunshot come from Hiram's room and had run into the room to find Hiram Knox Jr. sprawled across his bed. A .45 caliber pistol was in his right hand, laying across his chest. Hiram Knox Jr., who had been one of the wealthiest men in the timber industry, was dead. As investigators worked the scene, it appeared as though Hiram had taken his own life. They found two letters in his pocket. One was addressed to his mother, the other to his attorney. Both of the letters were written on stationery from the Brazos Hotel of Houston. The letters mentioned his recent struggle with depression and his financial struggles. But Sabine County Sheriff George Alford had his doubts. You see, Hiram Knox Jr. had died of a single bullet wound to the head, a single shot to the top back of his head, an awkward and rather unusual way for a man to shoot himself, especially considering where the gun was found, in his hand, laying on his chest. One important thing was missing that you would expect if someone had shot a gun: powder burns. Investigators found none on Hiram's hands or head. Within hours of Lillian's call to the sheriff and his arrival on scene, he suspected that Lillian Knox was the one who fired the shot that killed her husband. Now, suspecting a well-respected and beloved woman of committing murder is one thing. Proving it? Well, that would be a challenge. 10 days after Hiram Knox Jr. died, the county judge ruled that Hiram's manner of death was not suicide. It was murder. Hiram Knox Jr. was laid to rest a few days later. His funeral, hosted in the home of Lillian Knox's ex-husband, Roy LaRue, and his second wife. Sheriff Alford waited for the right time to arrest Lillian Knox. He was convinced she had made Hiram's death look like a suicide, that she had written the notes found in Hiram's pockets, and he theorized that Lillian may have had help with the murder. There had been a report in a local paper that a car with a powerful-sounding engine was heard speeding away from Lillian and Hiram's home shortly after the gun was fired, the morning Hiram died. The sheriff tried to track down the vehicle, but was never able to verify the make and model or who had been driving that day. The day of Hiram Knox's death, investigators also found the window in Hiram's room was open. They found a footprint from a man's shoe outside of the home, but that led them nowhere. Another obstacle Sheriff Alford faced in trying to find evidence that his murder theory was true was a lack of obvious motive. Lillian Knox was known as a faithful wife, and investigators found that there were no large insurance policies on Hiram's life. But Lillian was in the home the night Hiram died. She was the one who found him, and things just weren't adding up. Once the coroner and the judge had ruled that the death of Hiram Knox was murder, Sheriff George Alford charged Lady Bountiful with the murder of Hiram Knox Jr. Lillian was arrested on Christmas Day, 1922, as she was coming home from a holiday visit to Houston. Shortly after her arrest, Lillian sent a message to the American Lumberman Journal and other media outlets stating, "I am absolutely innocent and have no fear of the outcome." Prosecutors presented evidence to a grand jury, first addressing the manner in which Hiram was shot and how it was near impossible to kill yourself in the way Hiram was shot and died. As to the letters that had been found on Hiram's body, their authenticity was questioned when prosecutors showed samples of Lillian and Hiram's style of writing. They claimed that the husband and wife used the same stenographic style of writing, and Lillian knew it would be difficult to distinguish who had written the letter. As to Lillian and Hiram's relationship, it was the definition of "it's complicated." The grand jury heard testimony of frequent arguments between the Knoxes over their relationship and money. The prosecution argued that Lillian had taken the time to plan Hiram's murder to make sure she got it right. There was the allegation that Lillian had ordered a black mourning dress 2 days before her husband died, so she would have the proper attire to appear to be a grieving widow. The prosecution claimed Hiram had been given a sleeping potion so he would pass out and not fight back before he was shot and killed. Lillian's secretary testified that Lillian ordered him to buy a sleeping potion just days before Hiram died. The drugstore clerk confirmed the secretary made the purchase when she testified in front of the grand jury. Complicating matters for Lillian was a deed presented by the prosecution after it was discovered by a reporter from the Houston Post. The deed had been executed before Hiram's death, making it clear that all of his property, valued at several million dollars, would go to his wife. The deed listed in detail the Knox properties in Texas that were transferred to Lillian Knox and indicated that half of Hiram's estate had been transferred before his death and the remaining half would be transferred upon his death. Lillian Knox's defense attorney, Chester Collins, argued that there was no motive for Lillian to kill her husband, and the prosecution was basing his case solely on circumstantial evidence. Chester Collins also called on countless character witnesses who spoke of Lillian's upstanding character, how she was an angel in the community. In fact, the entire grand jury had been made up of people who benefited from the kindness of Lady Bountiful because of the company's town model. She was a former employer, and for many, a benefactor. The one thing Chester Collins left out when he was calling on character witnesses for Lillian Knox, he left out the fact that he had been in a long-term relationship with Lillian, his client. In fact, the prosecution claimed Lillian Knox was in a long-term relationship with a couple of men during her marriage to Hiram. The defense countered, claiming Lillian and Hiram had a thoroughly modern and open relationship. Chester was fine with Hiram. Hiram was fine with Chester. But an employee in the Knox household contradicted Lillian's claim when she was called by the prosecution. She testified that she heard Hiram say Chester Collins needed to stay away from his home or he was going to have to kill him to keep him away. Maybe Lillian killed for money, and maybe Lillian killed for love, to protect Chester Collins, and the money and property were just added incentive for murder. The grand jury didn't see it that way. They ruled there was not enough evidence to pursue the case. No indictment. Lillian was freed from jail. Over the next few months, she sold her personal assets, packed up her belongings, and left town. But Lillian wasn't one to remain quiet and off the radar for long. By 1924, Hiram Knox's will had been probated, and Lillian inherited what remained of his estate. Lillian had been away for a while, so when she returned to town in 1924 to exhume the graves of her father-in-law, Colonel Knox, Hiram Knox Jr.'s first wife, Grace, and their son, Willie Knox, people thought it was strange, to say the least. The bodies were shipped to Texarkana for reburial near Hiram Knox Jr. Then she resold the empty graves for $1 each. And this wouldn't be the last of Lillian's strange burial decisions. When her first husband, Roy LaRue, would die years later, and his second wife, Effie, died, Lillian ordered that they be buried next to her late husband, Hiram. Lillian's next move would take her to Dallas, Texas, where her mother-in-law, Mary Knox, was living. Mary and the colonel had been estranged before he died, but Mary was well cared for and lived a comfortable life in Dallas. When Lillian moved to Dallas in 1927, she leased a mansion and tried to make herself the talk of town. She told members of the press that she had been educated at a fancy school for women in New York, but her poor grammar and very strong country accent made it clear that she had not attended the school. Lillian wanted to be a Lady Bountiful of Dallas, but Dallas society just wasn't having it. They knew who she was, what she had been accused of in East Mayfield, and they didn't want to associate with her. Lillian was shunned by the people she needed to socialize with to gain acceptance in Dallas society. The money Lillian had inherited from Hiram was going fast. Within a few years of moving to Dallas, she could no longer afford to live in the fancy mansion she had rented. She moved her children into the attic of the home and turned it into a boarding house. In the beginning, things went well. She attracted respectable boarders. But things took a strange turn when some questionable people started showing up after hours. This made the respectable boarders nervous. They moved out, leaving Lillian with no income. She searched for work and found it at the St. George Hotel, working as a housekeeper from 1934 to 1935. But it would seem everything Lillian Knox associated herself with went downhill a bit. While she was working at the St. George, it became a popular gambling joint full of shady characters. She left for a while, but returned a few months later when the hotel was sold and renamed the Whitmore. The former Lady Bountiful's life was unstable. She had children to care for, but no steady and reliable income. Lillian Knox had inherited almost $10 million from Hiram Knox Jr., and by now, she had completely exhausted it. Her mother-in-law, Mary Knox, was in her 80s when Lillian moved to Dallas. She loved her grandchildren and made it clear that they were welcome in her home. But Mary Knox also made it clear that she felt Lillian was responsible for her son Hiram's death. She loved her grandchildren, but preferred to see very little of Lillian. The tension between the two was made clear to one of Mary Knox's neighbors in 1936, when Mary confided that she had learned her daughter-in-law Lillian was taking advantage of her. She didn't go into detail at the time, but Mary Knox did share that she was changing her will and leaving her estate to a Dallas orphanage. Her updated will left Lillian and each of the children just $5 each. In October of 1936, folks learned why Mary Knox had changed her will. An arrest warrant was issued for Lillian on charges of forging Mary Knox's name on 5 checks, taking more than $1,100 from her mother-in-law. She involved her oldest son, Hiram, in her crime. They would both be indicted for forgery on January the 2nd of 1937. When police moved in to arrest Lillian and her son, they couldn't find them. A little over 2 months later, on Friday, March 12th of 1938, a neighbor noticed that Mary Knox had not taken her usual morning walk. Mary's newspaper was still on the porch, and no matter how many times her neighbor rang the bell, no one answered. She called on a fellow neighbor who found a young man to climb through an unlocked window. He opened a back door, and the ladies entered. As they looked around the home, they noticed untouched cooked eggs and a pot of coffee on the kitchen table. More neighbors had entered the home by now because their 91-year-old neighbor hadn't been seen all day, and they were concerned. A neighbor walked into the parlor and then screamed as she saw Mary's body in a pool of blood on the floor. 91-year-old Mary Knox had been bludgeoned to death, her skull crushed in four places with what Dallas Police Detective Inspector Will Fritz believed to be an iron bar. As investigators worked the case of the murder of Mary Knox, they theorized that Mary had been preparing to sit down to breakfast when someone knocked on the front door. She was still in her nightgown, but went to open the door and let her killer in. Once Mary Knox's killer was inside, they choked her and bludgeoned her to death. There was a trail of blood from the front door to the parlor where Mary's body had been found, and a bloody footprint was found in the corner of the parlor near Mary's body. It appeared to be a man's shoe that left the prints. Investigators would later compare the footprint from the rug in Mary's home to the footprint found at Hiram Knox's home on the day he died. The prints were similar, but they weren't a verifiable match. Police also found that Mary's bedroom had been ransacked and a lockbox was missing from her room. Mary didn't trust banks after she experienced the collapse of banks during the Great Depression. Many of her generation felt the very same way. Mary kept cash in her home and on her person, normally wearing a money belt that was full of cash. She also kept large amounts of cash in a lockbox that had gone missing from her home. When investigators questioned Mary Knox's neighbors, they learned of what she shared about changing her will. They also learned she had started locking all of the doors in her home. It was an odd change for Mary because she normally kept her doors unlocked. Someone had shaken Mary Knox and made her very afraid. Detective Fritz believed the person who killed Mary Knox was someone she knew. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been allowed in the home early in the morning while she was still wearing her night clothes. Fritz believed that Mary Knox had been murdered by her daughter-in-law, Lillian Knox, after Lillian learned she had been disinherited. Fritz placed round-the-clock surveillance on Lillian Knox's house, and on Sunday, March 14th, 1937, that surveillance paid off when Lillian's son, Hiram, was spotted trying to enter the home. He was arrested, which prompted Lillian to contact Dallas PD to arrange her surrender. Lillian was taken into custody for the forgery warrants, and when questioned about the murder of her mother-in-law, Mary Knox, Lillian claimed she was in Texarkana on the day Mary Knox was killed. She said an old family rival must have killed Mary, but she didn't have a name for police. During her second interview with police, she said Mary had most likely been killed by a tramp or a thief who had been working on a property. Detective Fritz also questioned Lillian's son, Hiram, who had been spotted at his grandmother's house the day before she was murdered. He confessed he had been there, saying he asked his grandmother for $500. She said no, and he left and never went back. Lillian was released from jail after serving 9 days. She maintained her innocence, even offered a reward for the capture of her mother-in-law's killer. Detective Fritz did all he could to keep the case going. He questioned one male suspect, but that suspect had an alibi. There was never enough evidence to bring charges against Lillian Knox. Mary Knox's murder remains unsolved. The murder of their grandmother seemed to be the end of the road for Lillian and her children. A few of them had spoken openly with Detective Fritz, had concerns about their mother, weren't sure if she was involved in any way, but there were suspicions. Lillian wasn't a present, caring, or nurturing mother, so she and her children went their separate ways. Lillian's oldest son, Hiram, would go on to commit a few crimes, face jail time, and would eventually join the cadet corps after entering Texas A&M. He changed the course of his life by studying hard, becoming an engineer, and settling into a quiet life with his wife in Big Spring, Texas. The remaining Knox children were taken in by an elderly couple who had worked for Lillian. Lillian Knox left Dallas, but she didn't settle down or change the course of her life. In fact, her life of crime and mystery continued. She returned to Sabine County, where she begged old friends to write her checks to help her out during a difficult time. A few agreed, but their kindness would be in vain. Lillian would add a few zeros to the checks they gave her before cashing them under the alias of Helen Mullen. In 1939, she pled guilty to federal forgery charges and would spend a few years in prison in West Virginia. In the 1950s, Lillian would be back on the radar of police. By then, she had moved to Chicago, where she met a wealthy widow, Rose Muir. Rose Muir didn't know Lillian Knox. The woman she believed to be nursing her was Margaret Costello, one of Lillian's aliases. Margaret, or Lillian, was Rose's caretaker for a few years, nursing the disabled and wheelchair-bound woman, and all the while, Lillian was taking advantage of her. Following Rose's death in December of 1954, her estate administrator was charged with finding $53,000 in bonds that Rose owned. He summoned Lillian to court to give any information she could about the location of the bonds and how they could be recovered. Lillian testified she had no way of knowing about any of Rose's assets and didn't even know she owned bonds. Curiously, after Lillian testified, she disappeared. A warrant was issued for the arrest of Lillian Knox, so she used the alias Hazel Berry while she was on the run for 22 months. In October of 1956, Lillian was finally arrested when she took a few of the bonds, cashed them in, and police were able to track her to a hotel room. She was arrested and charged with making off with $53,000 in bonds. When police went to a locker in Grand Central Station where Lillian had stashed the bonds, she said she had no idea how they got there. Someone must have framed her. Police transferred Lillian back to Chicago to face charges. Lillian's trial was dramatic, to say the least. The state felt they had a solid case, but they failed to prove one important point. They failed to prove Rose Muir owned the bonds that Lillian had taken. Reasonable doubt is always the key to a good defense. The prosecution was unable to prove their case, which led the judge to order the jury to find Lillian Knox not guilty. Once again, Lillian Knox was accused of a crime and walked away free and clear. For the remainder of her life, Lillian never spoke of the death of Hiram Knox Jr. in East Mayfield or Mary Knox in Dallas, never spoke of the suspicious deaths of Colonel Knox, Hiram's first wife Grace, or their son Willie. If she was guilty of multiple murders, Lillian's sentence wasn't served behind bars. It would seem the sentence handed down to Lillian Knox was madness. Family who saw her later in life said she acted in peculiar ways, spoke out of her head. Her final residence would be listed as State Hospital at Kankakee, Illinois. Lillian Marshall Knox, the once Lady Bountiful of East Texas, died in the Illinois Mental Hospital in 1966. She was buried in a pauper's grave. The number 4608, the only clue to the identity of the person buried on the hospital grounds. None of Lillian's children were present when she was buried. As Elise Cabot has written, evil endures a moment's flesh and then leaves, but a burnt out shell. Southern Mysteries is hosted and produced by me, Shannon Ballard. Bob Bowman's The Mystery of Lady Bountiful was a rich resource of information on the mystery, along with Barti Hale's Unforgettable Texans. You can learn more about those books and about this episode and see photos of Lillian Knox in the full show notes at southernmysteries.com. I wanted to say thanks to those of you who have been listening to Southern Mysteries on the Radio Public app. When you listen on the free iOS or Android app, you're supporting Southern Mysteries because I get paid when you listen. It's an easy way to support the show and to discover new podcasts. Download the Radio Public app and add Southern Mysteries to your favorites. And then find new podcasts to listen to. Search through curated list of podcasts from creators and fans of podcasting. Wherever you listen, make sure you subscribe to Southern Mysteries so you never miss a new episode. Thanks so much for listening.